Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. Today, raw drama. Premier League, Watford removed Pearson faster than you, meeting your new in-laws. While in the Cup, it's Arsenal-Chelsea in the final. Arsenal cooking with Granit Xhaka and Oba on the counter, and Man U, like you after lockdown, needing to cut their hair. We rounded it all up. Welcome back, Leeds, to the Premier League, and look ahead to a dramatic final 7 days of the English season. It's the Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. Yeah, the kink's there, listener, with the topical question right now around Watford away. How are you doing? It is the 20th of July, and I'm delighted to say we're joined today by Daniel Storey.
Hi, James.
By Michael Cox.
Hi, James.
And by Adrian Clark.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Not at all, Adrian. Always a pleasure. Hello to you all on what is for us, listener, I have to say, a Sunday evening. Sunday evening immediately post the Chelsea-Man United FA Cup semi-final at Wembley. So much to discuss, though. DSK says, on the Totally Football Show on August the 8th, 2019, it was suggested that Watford are the best-run club in the Premier League. Maybe you should have a section for end-of-season bloopers. Crikey, who would have said that? Was it you, Daniel?
Probably was, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sticking with it, though. They had four managers in the season. They got promoted to the Premier League, so it works for them.
Brilliant. All right. Well, so many storylines. Let's start off, though, with the FA Cup, with the two big semi-finals, both featuring London sides taking on Mancunian opposition. And, of course, the result is that for the second time in 12 months, Arsenal and Chelsea will be facing off for a cup with almost none of their followers able to attend. Then it was in Baku, the Europa League, this time. Of course, the FA Cup final at Wembley on August the 1st. Chelsea 3-1 winners on Sunday against Man United. The big storyline here, I think, can be summarised by the fact that Roy Keane and Dean Henderson were both trending on Twitter during the game, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, that's what decided it, wasn't it? I mean, I thought this was, to be honest, after the previous night's semi-final, which I thought was a really intriguing game, I thought this was just quite poor quality. I thought both sides made a major tactical alteration to their starting 11 and just both seemed quite defensive and quite cautious and like they were reacting to the opposition rather than trying to play their own game, and didn't really see where source of good chances was coming from really until De Gea made, I mean, I thought the first one was quite a big error, to be honest, and then the second one, obviously, absolutely no question about that. And then what happened at 2-0 I thought was fairly inconsequential to the game because it felt like it was already won. So yeah, just goalkeeping errors really was the thing that swung it for me.
Mm. Olivier Giroud with the first goal, which caught De Gea out. The second one, no question really about it being the goalkeeper's error.
It was an absolute shocker. It really was. I did think the first one he was to blame for as well. Although, Olivier Giroud, is there a better player in world football at attacking a near post cross with the outside of your foot? I just don't think there is. Olivier Giroud is a true master at that. And you've got to expect it. When the ball comes into the area, you've got to expect the worst as a defender, as a goalkeeper. And I don't think David De Gea did there. And the second one was just awful. I mean, if Dean Henderson doesn't get a chance at the start of next season to be United's number one, it'll be a travesty, really, because this isn't a one-off. David De Gea has been a shadow, really, of the goalkeeper we once knew this season. And, you know, Roy Keane is, you have to laugh at his antics sometimes on air. I'm sure he plays up a little bit, but he was right about David De Gea. And I think they need to move on from him.
They need extreme measures to be taken against the keeper. No, you're probably right about the first goal. It's just that saying it was a goalkeeping error, I feel like it takes away from the glorious cheekiness of Giroud's touch with the outside of his boot there. United, beyond De Gea, though, had won all three previous meetings this season, two in the league, one in the cup. Was it just the goalkeeper's performance that was different, or was there something else behind this Chelsea victory?
Well, they obviously made a number of changes, which became, I think, inevitable once it became clear how tired they were against both against Southampton and against Crystal Palace in the second half. But it wasn't really, although they didn't play very well, it wasn't really the fault of those that came in that they lost the game. You know, Harry Maguire scores the own goal and somehow managed to stand out more and look clumsier in a three than a two. Eric Bailly and Victor Lindelof didn't. Lindelof lost Giroud for the first goal. De Gea obviously made the mistakes. He's been number one all season. So I think that's kind of an easy explanation. Daniel James didn't offer anywhere near the same as Mason Greenwood has in the last few weeks. And he's kind of tailed off badly this season. But other than that, I think you could point to the changes for the lack of maybe the lack of intensity and the lack of hounding in midfield, but not really for the defeat itself. That it was just individual error, I think.
I mean, I guess the debate is going to be, should Solskjaer have gone back to the system that had proved effective against Chelsea earlier in the season, as he did, or kept the side that has played well in recent weeks? Personally, when I saw the team selection, I thought it was a good call, a bold call to go to the three at the back and play that way. What I think he could have done differently was just be braver in some selections. Because when you look at the side, it just does seem quite defensive. You know, essentially five defenders. I mean, Daniel James really has not done much after Christmas, and I thought that was a surprise selection here. I think you could have played Martial in that position and get him to play from wide. And then down the flanks, rather than Bailly and Wan-Bissaka. I mean, Wan-Bissaka, I think, is perfectly suited to the right side of a three-man defence rather than playing as wing-back. Maybe you could have played Daniel James there as a wing-back and played Wan-Bissaka as a right-sided centre-back. It just brings a little bit more attacking intent to the side. And the other thing I'd say is, you know, he took the opportunity with that Eric Bailly injury to bring on Martial and go back to the four at the back. I'm surprised at half-time he didn't then go for Pogba straight away. Because that, you know, he was returning to the system that's worked well in recent weeks. And to me, it seemed like Fred was well off the pace. So I would have just immediately put Matic as the sole holding midfielder and injected Pogba. Whether that would have changed things, we don't know, of course.
Beyond what United did or didn't do, though, was this game a fabulous Chelsea performance? And was this evidence that Frank Lampard can progress, that he is developing as a manager and Chelsea are going places?
Well, he's learning on the job, isn't he, Frank Lampard? I think he is improving. He's used this formation in several big matches this season for Chelsea, and it's worked more often than it hasn't worked. So I think it's the right system for them. I think, actually, just as it is with Arsenal at the moment, Arsenal do not have good enough defenders to play with a back four against elite opposition right now. That's why they've gone to three. And it worked spectacularly against City and against Liverpool. It's a similar case, I think, for Chelsea. I don't know if Frank really trusts his centre halves at the moment, especially in a back four. And I just feel it's the right system for them at the moment. And that was why I felt Chelsea had the tactical edge. It was a system that suited them today. For me, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer picked his shape around the players that he wanted to rest and leave out. It was like, right, what am I left with? Okay, which formation works for that? And he's gone with James as a wide forward of sorts and other selections. I just don't think it clicked for them.
So he's prioritising the league campaign there?
Yeah, this is priority number three, isn't it? Clearly, the Champions League is up for grabs in the Premier League, so he needs to pick his best team for that. And obviously, if they do miss out, then they've also got the backstop of the Europa League where you have to consider them favourites. So although he didn't throw the FA Cup semi-final, of course he didn't, he certainly didn't pick his strongest available side.
I think the other thing it shows is that Chelsea clearly have greater strength in depth than Manchester United. You know, they didn't have Christian Pulisic, they didn't have N'Golo Kante. But you look at the players they were still able to bring off the bench, and Tammy Abraham and Ruben Loftus-Cheek. There's clearly a greater strength there. Manchester United have been brilliant with that first choice 11, and there's a reason why Solskjaer keeps picking them for every league game and playing that front foot football because it suits them. But beyond that, scratch below the surface, and there's really very little left in the cupboard for him to call upon. And that is what he needs to push the club to solve this summer if they're going to be pushing for any more than exactly the same again next season.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, make sure you check out their coverage of each and every Premier League club by taking out a free 30-day trial by heading to theathletic.com/totally.
Tierney just to chip one in behind. Lovely ball that for Aubameyang, who's got Lacazette up there with him. This could be another goal, could it? It is! Aubameyang! And Arsenal have done it again!
Chelsea anyway reaching the FA Cup final for the third time in 4 years, where they will be facing Arsenal, who did, on Saturday, put out the holders. It's only a week ago that we were here discussing Arsenal losing to Spurs and Arteta being locked into the same issues that had plagued and bedeviled all his predecessors. And in the meantime, in the interim, he's gone on and beat, or Arsenal have gone on and beaten the last two Premier League champions in succession. Adrian, what on earth happened?
Well, they've focused on defence, that is for sure. And the players have played with incredible discipline. I do believe, and this is nothing to do with football, but I believe that he is a strict disciplinarian, Mikel Arteta. We've seen that with his treatment of Matteo Guendouzi, to some degree Mesut Ozil as well. That was a big line in the sand. And I think that the players have full respect for him, and they're also buying into his methods. There was real concentration and discipline in both performances. I just felt it was quite inspired, really, in terms of several individuals within the team. David Luiz had his once a season heroic effort, didn't he? Every now and again, he just produces these displays that remind you why he's had such a long career at the highest level. Kieran Tierney was exceptional by his side, playing as a narrow centre back. Granit Xhaka, I think, produced his best first half ever in an Arsenal shirt. He was magnificent. And throughout the team, there was just a real unity. And Arteta clearly realised City's weaknesses. He knew what they didn't like facing. And the players went and implemented that game plan properly. And for the two goals, I don't think it's any coincidence that City's full-backs were exposed. That's clearly the weak link with them, with Mendy and Walker, not great defenders. And for both goals, Kyle Walker switched off. Actually, for both goals, both players switched off because Mendy was playing Aubameyang onside as well. So, I think Arteta just had Pep's measure on this one.
I hear he used to be Guardiola's assistant. Is that right? is this a one-off, you feel, for David Luiz? This is the exception rather than what happened last time he took on Man City. A lot of people have been painting this as the game of redemption for the Brazilian, for Granit Xhaka, and possibly one or two other players as well. Michael, what do you think? Do you see green shoots here?
Yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed with Arteta overall, as I've said. I think at times here they rode their luck. I thought a 0-0, Arsenal were really on the back foot in not a tactical way. I think they were just struggling to get out of their own third. But they did have they had that good Aubameyang chance even before the opening goal. And I thought after they went 1-0 up, they played it pretty well. They were relatively comfortable, I'd say, for long periods when they were defending deep. They did offer a counter-attacking threat. And I think it's significant that both goals came in different ways from being calm and patient when they played out from the back. I mean, I've written an article today for The Athletic all about their patience. And I contrasted it with a game that was the first game of Emery's reign at the Emirates against Manchester City last year, where Arsenal tried to play out from the back early. It went wrong and the crowd were really getting on their back, and eventually Cech just hoofed it downfield and all the Arsenal fans sarcastically cheered. I think the fact there was no fans here after the early era they had where they played out from the back might have helped them, because actually I think it's probably easier to do that in a kind of situation where you're not surrounded by 90,000 fans. And the first goal was absolutely brilliant, a brilliant example of playing forward. And I thought that the system Arteta used worked really well. And a really big moment for him as a manager. I mean, the Liverpool result, I think, was slightly fortunate, and there's question marks about Liverpool's motivation. But to beat Manchester City in an FA Cup semi-final, I think, was really impressive.
Adrian, having played at this level, is that fair that one of the reasons that Arsenal are doing better now is that they don't have the crowd on their backs?
it's a big question. I think you could say yes and no. I definitely think Michael's got a point on the playing out from the back, because fans in general are a bag of nerves when teams play out from the back. Maybe unless you're a City fan, because you're so used to it and you know that they're pretty brilliant at it. Arsenal fans don't really trust Mustafi, David Luiz and these guys at the back when they've got the ball at their feet. So yes, I think that in that sense, it may well have helped. And the two goals came from sort of full length of the pitch moves, didn't they? I also felt that turnovers were going to be really important in this game. We know that City like to play out themselves, And Arsenal were never going to have much of the ball in this game. Therefore, it was absolutely imperative when City did play out from the back, they were really assertive and aggressive in the way they tried to nick the ball. Because basically, working the ball that far up the pitch wasn't going to happen too often in the game. And really, Aubameyang should have scored from one of the turnovers, if not from two. So yeah, Arteta, I think, definitely had the right idea here. But I would credit the players just purely for their focus. It was a million times better than the performance against Liverpool, which I thought was a little bit lucky, if I'm honest. There was a bit of good fortune here with City's poor finishing, but to limit them to one shot on target is amazing. And there's a stat that I discovered today that in a domestic match, City, you have to go all the way back to March 2017 when they played Stoke for the last time they had just one shot on target in a domestic game. So look, that's an achievement for Arsenal.
It's also, I think, a victory that is greater than the sum of its own immediate impact, because Arteta over the last week has made no secret of his public demand for the club to back him in the transfer market. And if Arsenal had fallen with a whimper to Liverpool and Manchester City, that there might be the sense within the Arsenal boardroom of, well, kind of, what's the point? All we're going to be playing for is exactly this again next season, so why throw 150 million at it? But actually, they have someone now that fans trust implicitly, which they didn't do with Unai Emery and they didn't do with Arsene Wenger during the last 2 years. It's a long time since this support has been completely united behind a manager, but they are now. And Arteta has that bargaining chip within the club's hierarchy to say, hang on a minute, I've shown you what I can do by improving what I inherited. Now give me a chance to put some shine on that. Now give me a chance to improve the parts of the team that have pretty obvious flaws in them and build something a little bit more special.
Part of that might be keeping hold of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who may have missed a few chances on Saturday, also scored some pretty special goals there, Adrian.
not half. I mean, yeah, it was an easy chart. I think that 1v1, he tucks it in the bottom corner 8 times out of 10. But the half volley was exquisite technique. And for it to come just a few minutes after that glaring miss, I think is the mark of a real world-class forward, because he didn't let that affect him. And it was instinctive brilliance. Good ball from Pepe as well. The second goal, he had all the time in the world, but was ice cold, just deliberately went through the legs. But yeah, Aubameyang, you hope, don't you? And Arteta did reference this afterwards. You do hope that kind of special night might just persuade him to stick around and believe in the Arteta project. There's no doubt he could get a club in the Champions League if he wants one. But Arsenal fans do love him. Arteta clearly does. He's the skipper. He's got the chance potentially to be part of a resurrected Arsenal. Arsenal fans desperate for him to stay.
Indeed so. Any further thoughts on this weekend of FA Cup semi-finals?
I mean, it's worth making the point, as excellent as Arsenal were, it's another capitulation for Manchester City and another game in which they've proven themselves incapable of getting back into a match having fallen behind, which has been their biggest issue under Pep Guardiola. There's some incredible stat about Manchester City, which I think goes back to about 1995, about their inability to win games when they're losing at half time. But in general, their inability to react and the way that goals seem to hurt them doesn't bode particularly well for a mini knockout tournament in Portugal in, you know, over the next month or so, because
assuming they get to it.
Exactly. They've got a very difficult second leg against a Real Madrid that look in very different health than they did when City beat them. And City look in different health too, because score early and score first against them, and it feels like you can get into their heads a little bit.
Daniel, I've got a stat on that because I did a bit of prep for the show that I do for Arsenal TV yesterday. I was talking about the need to score first. Now, in their previous 10 defeats, it's now 11, previous 10 defeats, they'd gone 1-0 down 9 times, but they'd gone 2-0 down 6 times. So they've now gone 2-0 down in 7 of their 11 defeats, which certainly backs up the point you make. And look, ahead of that Real Madrid game, that's a slightly worrying statistic, I'd imagine, for Pep and for City fans.
Well, that was the FA Cup. Looking forward to the final on the 1st of August. Meanwhile, though, on Sunday, threatening to upstage all of that, was the Premier League. You had Bournemouth battling for their top flight future. You had Leicester scrapping for their top four spot. And you had Watford kicking it all off by firing Nigel Pearson with just 2 games to go in the season. We'll be discussing that and more next.
I thought I'd never see you again. I missed how you made me feel, the excitement you brought me, but I never stopped loving you.
Did you just say something, mate?
Oh, just looking at the Premier League fixtures, like...
Absence makes the heart grow fonder, so it's never been a better time to be a football fan. Celebrate with the Acca Cracker from Paddy Power. It covers all games on all markets, and if one leg folds, you get a free bet. Paddy Power!
Max free bet £10, minimum odds of 1 to 5 on for each leg. T's and C's apply, 18 plus, bgambleaware.org.
Listeners, it's time to talk about shaving. It's time to talk about Harry's. Just because I've been rocking a beard since the mid-90s doesn't mean I don't need to get my shave on. My neck and upper cheek always need attention. The good news is Harry's Cucumber and Aloe Shave Gel lathers into a luxurious foam, allowing their precision-engineered blades to glide across your face, making you look smooth and handsome. What's more, Harry's razors have a non-slip handle with a textured grip, more Alison Becker, say, than Loris Carius. So, if you're fed up with overpriced razors, why not get yourself a Harry's trial set sent right to your door for just £3.95. It's got everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. That aforementioned handle, in your choice of blue, orange or green, a five-blade razor cartridge with a lubricating strip, a trimmer blade, that rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. All you have to do is head to harrys.com/totallyfootball. That's harrys.com/totallyfootball.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
So, Sunday morning, the man famous for his ostrich press conference, himself ostrich-sized by his club, Watford letting Nigel Pearson go with two matches remaining in the season. He's the third manager they've sacked this campaign, the second one after a 3-1 defeat by a West Ham. It was the same scenario that preceded Javi Gracia departing the club. But Pearson leaving the Hornets 3 points outside the drop zone, having inherited them 6 points from safety. Why? What now? All those kind of things. Let's ask a man in the know, paging Mike Parkin of From the Rookery End podcast. Mike, thank you for joining us on this fateful Sunday evening. First of all, the nation agog for Nigel Pearson answers. Why? Why now?
I mean, you can look at it too. There's two possible options at play here. I think one of them is the pretty poor run of form. I think since lockdown, Watford haven't performed as they'd have hoped in a bid to get clear of this. They've had seven matches, and in each of those seven matches, the first half performance has been really, really bad, lacking in any intensity. So that is something to look at. But potentially, there's rumours, stories circulating of certainly a disagreement at some stage during the game on Friday, which would make sense if you bear in mind the performance, probably the biggest game in Watford's Premier League history against West Ham on Friday night. They obviously lost it 3-1 after going in at half-time 3-0 down. So I think there's some suggestion that game has lit the blue touch paper, shall we say.
Yeah, the fact that they didn't wait for the end of the season or even for the end of the Bournemouth result, which does leave them pretty well placed to stay up, suggests there'd been a major falling out. So in terms of rumours, there weren't any kind of undercurrents of unrest between Pearson, say, and the Podsoe family?
Not that I'm aware of, James. No, I mean, the only thing that we can look at is those first half performances from these games have been really sort of getting at me. It's been very hard to understand why a team in such terrible trouble in a relegation battle hasn't been able to translate the sort of urgency of the situation into urgent performances on the pitch. And that did sort of, it has been a red flag for some, but certainly no concrete indication that there was any problem with relationships behind the scenes. But the results and the performances have certainly given us cause to believe that something might not be quite right. It hasn't felt as we'd expect it to feel since lockdown, if that makes sense.
Hayden Mullins steps in for the second time this season, and his first game in charge will be Manchester City at home on Tuesday. The campaign ends with Arsenal away. So how confident are you about his and the team's prospects of staying in the Premier League, Mike?
About as confident as the next manager lasting more than 6 months, I think. It's going to be very, very difficult. I think Watford, Villa and Bournemouth, it's still all to play for all three sides. Watford have by far and away got the hardest run in. Villa go to West Ham on the last day, who are already safe, and Bournemouth go to Everton, who are in a similar situation and haven't been in great form themselves. So I think as Watford supporters, we're expecting Villa and Bournemouth certainly to get 3 points on the final day. So with that in mind, it's looking like a damage limitation exercise for Watford on Tuesday night. Their record against Manchester City over the past couple of seasons has been absolutely horrendous. I won't even try to add up the amount of goals. It takes, I think it probably takes 14 a degree in pure math.
No, 14 in the last two.
Thank you, James.
And none scored. 14 conceded.
Yes, yeah, so you can understand why I'm perhaps a little bit reticent to look forward to it with too much glee. So I think, genuinely speaking, and this does sound a little bit defeatist, but I think Tuesday will be damage limitation. Try and keep the goals down so that the goal difference doesn't take too much of a hammering going into that nerve-jangling final day. I think it's, at the moment, it's a toss of a coin. I think those 3 points Watford are out ahead is a bit of a misnomer, because then they've got Arsenal on the last day and anything could happen in that one. So Watford do have the upper hand in the 3 points, but I think it's going to go down to that last day and potentially goal difference.
Mike, were the fans okay with Pearson and his work? Because from the outside looking in, it seemed to me like he just found his best team, or certainly his best forward line, with Welbeck one side, Saar the other, and Doucouré behind Welbeck. I'd imagine that there were very few Hornets fans unhappy with that. I mean, do you think he was doing anything wrong tactically?
The post-lockdown form has been really concerning, actually. And I think we as Watford supporters expected more post-lockdown. We thought Nigel Pearson, Craig Shakespeare, excellent man managers. And as you mentioned there is talent in this Watford squad. So we were hoping that they'd come out all guns firing, hit the ground running. I'll leave the cliches there. But you know what I mean, just to drag themselves clear. They had a couple of winnable games early on, and there has been definite concern about the post-lockdown form. It's been very, very curious and hard to put our fingers on it. So there's been disappointment in that respect. But if you look at Nigel Pearson's body of work over the piece, Watford had 9 points when he came in at around about Christmas time. They were cut adrift at the bottom. They were some way clear of getting clear of relegation. So for him to have manoeuvred Watford into a situation where we're in with a chance going into the final week is cause for praise, really. They've done an incredible job to turn it round, and obviously still in with a chance. And there have been some notable results along the way. Wolves, Manchester United and Liverpool all lost at Vicarage Road. So largely speaking, Nigel Pearson's done an incredible job, and I think Watford supporters were happy with him. It's just this last 7 games, this post-lockdown period, has left people feeling a little bit bewildered, baffled, and not quite sure as to whether he is actually the man to take Watford forward. So it's been a curious, curious couple of months.
Right. Well, the bewilderment only increasing after Sunday's events. Mike, thank you so much for joining us with that, and look forward to discovering more about the background to Sunday's decision. But best of luck for the week ahead.
Thank you very much, chaps.
Mike Parkin of From the Rookery End podcast, the latest edition of which should be out very soon, actually. Yeah, one or two stories flying around about the row during the West Ham defeat, and indeed afterwards, that has presumably sparked this decision.
Yeah, I mean, I think if Watford had immediately announced a permanent, in inverted commas, given that it's Watford's successor to Pearson, then we could think that this was about style of play. The fact that they've given the job to Hayden Mullins again for 2 games suggests that there's been a massive row. And that's what the story suggests, that there's a kind of untenable row between Pozzo and Pearson that ended in him being sacked. The interesting thing for me is that they asked Craig Shakespeare to stay on for 2 games to do it, his assistant, which, given how close Shakespeare and Pearson are and how close Shakespeare and the Pozzo family aren't, seems an extraordinarily bold move. And Shakespeare, by all accounts, gave them pretty short shrift and said he would be sticking with Pearson.
West Ham gave them short shrift as well. Well done, David Moyes, eh? Last 6 results, they've beaten Chelsea 3-2, they put 4 past Norwich, and then this key game, they win 3-1. David Moyes keeping the Hammers up for the second time. There's been a lot of negativity about the chosen one, but I say it's time to give him a round of applause, eh, Michael?
Yeah, I thought West Ham's owners, who I'm not a particular fan of, and I do think there's major questions to ask about their ownership in general. I don't think it was a bad move going back to Moyes, actually, because they brought him in. They brought him in twice to do a very specific job. And I think when you take it every step of the way, I understand their decisions. I understand why they wanted to move on from Moyes, who's quite a defensive short-term manager in a way that he does a good job, to stabilise the side, and wanted to move on to Pellegrini. And I thought that was a decent appointment. That didn't work out. And in a way, I thought it was quite a brave move to go back to Moyes. whether he, you know, he's got a contract for next year because he wasn't going to take just a 6-month contract. You're in the same situation as you were, what, 2 seasons ago. I appreciate that. Whether he's the man to take them forward, I don't know. But I think he has stabilised the side. He's got the best in recent weeks from the likes of Jared Bowen, I've been really impressed by on the right. Obviously, Mikhail Antonio up front. Suchek as well, a player I really didn't know much about in January. He's come in and done a really good job. So this was a huge victory for them. At the bottom of the table just seals their survival, doesn't it? So, yeah, I'm relatively pleased for Moyes, who I think tends to get a little bit of a harsh rap.
Well, earlier on Sunday, another big game down the bottom saw Bournemouth beaten 2-0 by Saints. Danny Ings, as usual, on the score sheet, although subsequently had a penalty saved. He's on 21 for the season. And then in stoppage time, that equaliser that Bournemouth thought they had from Sam Surridge disallowed for offside, and Che Adams nipping in for Saints to wrap up the victory. Heartbreak again for Bournemouth. Is that it? If Watford get a point against Man City on Tuesday, it is. The Cherries will be relegated. If City win, Bournemouth must win at Goodison Park on the final day to have any chance of staying up. That sounds doable to me.
I think so. Yeah, Everton aren't playing especially well at the moment. And Bournemouth, I thought, were brilliant at Manchester City. Unlucky, really, to lose that game. And they started fabulously against Southampton. They really did. They were tearing down the wings. I thought Stanislas was having another good game, and they were flashing balls across the box. It was just the finish that was missing. If they can just find that finishing touch, they've got a chance against an Everton team that really have got nothing to play for. I wouldn't rule them out at all there. The issue all season for me with Bournemouth have been creativity, though. They've gone backwards in that regard hugely. They've always, under Eddie Howe, created loads of chances, scored quite a few goals, but leaked loads. This year, they've still leaked loads, but at the top end of the pitch, they've plummeted. I think there's only one side in the division that creates less than Bournemouth from open play. So that really is the reason why they're in this muddle.
Basically, yeah, Bournemouth are Arsenal fans for the week, because Villa play Arsenal on Tuesday night and then Watford play Arsenal on the final weekend. If they do beat Everton, and we assume Watford take up no points against Man City and Arsenal, which is an assumption, obviously, it only takes Villa to lose to Arsenal and then Bournemouth to win on the final day and they should be safe, which is remarkable given how bad they've been over the last 3 or 4 months. And if they play like they did in the first half against Southampton, like Adrian says, they probably will beat Everton. But it is clearly firmly out of their own hands now. And they did look absolutely exactly the same as Villa looked broken by the Theo Walcott equaliser against Everton. They looked broken by that disallowed goal. And you just kind of think, with this relentless schedule, how hard is it going to be to pick up those players again?
Do you guys feel that Eddie Howe looks a bit broken? Because it just seems to me that he's had this sort of vacant look in his eyes for quite a while now.
No, I agree completely with Adrian. And I think, you know, we tend to think about managers keeping their jobs or losing their jobs as kind of a reward for past performance. But with Howe, I actually think it's the opposite, in the sense that if they go down, I think I'd stick with him, because he's shown that he's got what it takes to get them up in the first place. But if they do stay up, it just seems to me like they've a little bit run out of ideas. And, you know, sometimes coaches just reach a point where they've said everything they can say to a group of players, and in terms of Premier League survival, maybe you'd look to get someone else in. So yeah, no, I agree with Adrian. He just looks really at the end of his tether and slightly, yeah, just lacking in ideas, I think.
On the subject of the Gunners being the Bournemouth team of necessity for the next 7 days, Mike asks, are Arsenal actually better off resting players in their last 2 league games, given that the FA Cup final is likely their best chance of Europa League qualification?
Well, I think it's a week, isn't it, between the last game of the season and the Saturday. So, I mean, I think tactically they'll be working on the training ground with a view to playing against Chelsea, certainly. But whether they need to rest players, I'm not so sure.
Okay. European places is what we're going to be talking about next as we focus on the top four.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Big news in the race for Champions League places came on Sunday afternoon as Leicester were defeated 3-0 by Tottenham Hotspur, leaving Chelsea, Leicester and Man United still separated by just 1 point. in a race for two Champions League spots. Of course, Chelsea and Man United now have a game in hand on the Foxes. Before we talk about Leicester and their prospects, let's have some Mourinho love. That's, what, five games since the defeat to Sheffield United, in which Spurs have picked up four wins and a draw, and they're really looking like a Mourinho team now, eh?
Yeah, not just in the kind of defensive solidity as plan A, B and C, but also as a kind of counter-attacking team. They have been helped by, and this is not to try and undersell their recent run of form, but they were helped hugely by a very poor Leicester team. But Mourinho seems to have found a way to get Harry Kane and Heung-min Son as a partnership. I know Kane will always get the headlines because he's brilliant, but to manage to get Son and Kane working off each other and Lucas Moura as kind of the roaming third member of that trio, that looks to be fixed. And central midfield looks good as well. I thought Harry Winks was probably the best player against Leicester. When he plays well, I think they tend to play well. And it saddened me because I don't think he plays well as often as I'd like. I think he could be England's answer if he kept it consistently. But he was excellent at ticking over possession. And Giovanni Lo Celso is, I don't know, probably Kane aside, maybe been their player of the season. So I think once they get those elements right, it very quickly looks like things can fall into place because they will always be, or they should always be, solid at the back when they play like this.
Well, they're up to sixth place now, 4 points behind Jose's former employers, Man United. Leicester, meanwhile, level with Man United, but it's very precarious indeed. A lot's been said about the 14-point lead they had over fifth place back around the turn of the year and how that's dissipated. And a lot of fingers, I think, pointed at Brendan Rodgers. Is that entirely fair? Do you think it's injuries? Is it the sheen coming off for Rodgers as manager? Where do you feel that this has all gone wrong for the Foxes?
I think that injuries have mainly been the problem. When you lose Chilwell, Maddison, Ricardo, obviously Suanchu for the last couple of games, it's going to make a big difference. You've got to remember that Leicester had the most stable starting 11 in the Premier League pre-lockdown. It was a 4-1-4-1, and we could all name every single player in the lineup. He barely changed it, and it worked. It was a nice little groove. Into March, or early March, late February, they were going a bit flat anyway. But since then, of course, they've had injuries. And what he's done is not only have to bring in squad players that didn't have a great deal of match practice, clearly not as good, the likes of Ryan Bennett and Justin and these guys, Wes Morgan, of course. He's been on the bench for a reason this season. Not only did he have to rely on squad players, he's had to change the shape as well, or he's chosen to change the shape. So there's been a lot of disruption for Leicester City, and I think that is the main reason. You can look at games like Bournemouth in isolation and say, yeah, it was the character let them down. There wasn't much spirit there, and that was true. But I think it's a culmination of just too many changes.
Losing both those fullbacks and losing Pereira in particular is massive because it's made them so much easier to defend. Because if you're not, you know, with all due respect to James Justin and Christian Fuchs, they're not going to create the same number of chances as Chilwell and Pereira. They were arguably the second best pair of fullbacks in the league behind Liverpool's. So which just means that you can cram the centre of the pitch. You can starve Maddison of space, you can starve Vardy of space, and everything just begins to look a bit staccato and lethargic, I think. And to be fair, that is the one criticism of Brendan Rodgers' career. Even at Celtic, how well he did there, their supporters will tell you, possibly with a touch of bitterness in their voices, that this was the problem, that they were in games they weren't expected to win. When the pressure got on, it felt like Rodgers lost his bottle a little bit and just went safety first.
I mean, it's worth keeping some perspective with Leicester. I know there's been a massive downturn since February, maybe. But I mean, if you'd said at the start of the season that Leicester would be in this position, you know, challenging Chelsea and Manchester United and probably going to the final day with the opportunity to finish in the Champions League positions, you would have said they've had a really good season. So I hope people aren't too harsh on Rodgers, because I still think he's massively overachieving with this side.
I think with Rodgers, there's a slight tendency to pile on when things take a downturn, just because of the perceived character that he has,
I agree,
the perceived notion he has of himself.
I agree, and I think that has really, really affected his reputation when you consider that he's been at three big-ish clubs, or he's had three big jobs, I'd say, in Swansea, Liverpool, Celtic, and he did a really good job at all of them. And yet when Leicester appointed him, people were questioning why. You know, he consistently does do a good job, but does seem to irritate people, doesn't
he? Well, he seems like a nice enough guy to me. The players seem to get on okay with him, don't they? And I know that the media that he deals with after matches, they're very happy with Brendan. He's always accommodating.
I thought you were going to say a comedy, but
he's a little bit David Brent. We know that, don't we? But yeah, I'm sure we can forgive him for that. Surely,
it's going to be a huge final day of the season. Midweek, as mentioned, Man United take on West Ham. Liverpool are hosting Chelsea, and then Leicester on the final day have Man United round at theirs, effectively probably to decide who gets that Champions League spot. Wow. All right, well, next up, tales of Leeds United, who, as you may have heard, are now up from the Championship and back in the top flight after 16 long years.
Tears on the terraces, tears on the field, and I'm sure tears in the dressing room as well. It'll be a long, long road back for Leeds United, but with supporters like those, it could be shorter.
Well, just the 16 years after that dramatic afternoon, 16 years, 15 managers, 5 owners, Leeds United are back. The club that became a byword for mismanagement and collapse, doing a Leeds effectively, now looking a very different kind of outfit. Confirming promotion on Friday thanks to rivals West Brom, getting done by Huddersfield. And joining us now to discuss Leeds being back in the Premier League is Phil Hay, Athletic's Leeds correspondent and, of course, host of The Phil Hay Show. Phil, thanks for joining us. First of all, how is the city dealing with this latest development?
Well, it's difficult because we still have COVID restrictions in place, and they were never going to stay indoors en masse on Friday. And when it was confirmed that Leeds were up, there were about 5,000 outside Elland Road, and flares and fireworks and everything else. And I find it very hard to begrudge them that, despite, you know, the kind of pressure to distance at the moment, because it's difficult to explain exactly what the last 16 years have been like. It hasn't even just been mediocre. There have been points in it where it's been horrendous. It's been administration, insolvency. You've had owners who've looked totally out of their depth and have, from, you know, our standpoint, looked like they were doing more damage than good to Leeds. And there were genuinely times where you wondered if it would ever happen. And I have to say, if it hadn't happened this season under Bielsa, I think financially and in terms of the structure of the club, they would have had problems over the summer. I think they would have had to have cut back. I'm not convinced that they would have found a way for Bielsa to stay or to give him a squad that could have competed like this one. So people understood the enormity of it. And because of that, it has been 3 or 4 days of drinking, and I didn't expect anything less. And the one sad thing about this is that had it been a normal season and had it been normal times minus any COVID restrictions, you would have seen hundreds of thousands on the street in Leeds. It would have been identical to the 92 title win and promotion in 1990. You would have had people everywhere. And you know, I sympathise really that that's been taken from the city, because it would have been a huge day. But nonetheless, people are taking it for what it is and are very, very grateful to Bielsa.
Phil, for any 16-year-olds listening, how big a deal is it having Leeds back in the top flight?
It is. I mean, it's always been the case that when people have said you need Leeds back in the Premier League, that you have to see it in the context of a club who actually, in a lot of respects, the organisation and the recruitment and the choice of head coaches and so on, haven't actually deserved to be at that level for a long time now. There have been very few seasons where they've looked like a Premier League side in the wrong division, or where they've looked like they've got anything like the structure or the vision or the plan to get there. They've been in the Championship for 10 years and actually have floated in it for the best part of 8. This is under Bielsa. This is the first time they've really looked like boss in the division. It's the first time they've been able to bully the rest of the division. But it's a big story. And I think you saw from the reaction to the promotion on Friday night and the interest in it on Twitter and social media and everybody else that people are pretty intrigued by what comes next year.
Similarly, the Bielsa burnout doesn't seem to have happened this time. Has he changed, or was it a benefit of the long suspension this season has had?
That may well have made the difference. And he has changed to a degree this season. It isn't vastly different, and he doesn't crack the whip in a way that you would, if you were looking on, would make you think that he was going easy on them. But he did learn to back off slightly. There was quite a key moment in the game recently against Stoke City at Elland Road, which leads 1-5-0. He had Hernandez on the bench for that game, who had a slight hamstring strain, but had recovered enough to be in the squad. And he put him on at half-time, but then took him off again before the end of the game. And it is just little things like starting to manage players' bodies, you know, to know that there was no need to push Hernandez to the end of that because the game was already won, so take a bit of care. There are times where he doesn't flog them in quite the same way as he did last season. But in terms of the burnout, I think there are two aspects of it with Bielsa. You're either talking physically or mentally, or in some cases both. And I didn't think that they burnt out physically at all last season. I thought they still had plenty in the tank. But I think mentally they did get stressed. I think the nerves did get to them. They seemed better prepared to handle what was coming. And they finished this off pretty emphatically. And as it turns out, they're probably going to win the league by a good 6-7 points, something like that, which is no easy going in the Championship.
What do you think is going to happen to Leeds in the Premier League?
Well, I'm sure they'll retain Bielsa. They'll speak to him this week. He wants to stay. They want to keep him. That kind of goes without saying. But as ever with Bielsa, it's not always that straightforward. They'll need to obviously meet him in terms of the actual strict aspects of the finances and the contract itself. But there are always things that Bielsa looks for beyond that, which is transfer strategy and infrastructure, changes to the training ground and to his backroom team. But I don't see Leeds objecting to anything that he asks if it's reasonable. And the way he's been in the 2 years here, I'm sure it will be. He'll take a lot of these players with him. They will sign players, but I think we spoke to Angus Kinnear yesterday. I think you'll be looking at 4 or 5 rather than 8, 9 or 10. And I suspect that the starting lineup on the first day of next season in the Premier League will be very, very similar to his strongest lineup this season in the Championship. And tactically, I don't see a big shift coming either. And that is probably the big question for Bielsa. Is it going to work for him when he tries these tactics in the Premier League? If it does, I can see Leeds being very comfortable next season. If it doesn't, then it isn't really Bielsa's way to adapt and to change his strategy. His attitude tends to be to redouble it and to trust that it will come good eventually. So he is an unknown quantity in that league, although I think that the league will be absolutely delighted to have him and it'll be, you know, stories galore with him. And a lot of these players are unknown quantities as well. So it would be difficult making predictions at the moment, aside from to say that he will trust a lot of them and I don't expect many of them to leave the club.
And Phil, 16 years they've been waiting for this in Leeds. How long have you been following the club?
15 years for me. The first game I ever covered for them was the 2006 playoff final, when they lost to Watford. And I actually joined the Yorkshire Evening Post the week that the Yorkshire Consortium bought them in 2004, and literally about 2 or 3 weeks before they were relegated. So I have seen the League One years, and I've seen the kind of wasted drift of the Championship years when they didn't compete. There was a season under Simon Grayson where it looked possible, certainly the playoffs looked possible. There was a season under Gary Monk where you thought they would get to the top six. But I think with Bielsa, it's the first time that you genuinely thought that they'd managed to land on somebody who might not only get them up, but get them up automatically, and as it turns out, win the title. I think he had this potential and he's delivered on it.
Phil Hay of The Phil Hay Show. Leeds, are they a big addition to the Premier League? Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, they undoubtedly are. You'll look through their fixture list next season. It's very rare that you see a match between a member of the Big Six and a promoted club and think that is appointment television. But the reality is it will be appointment television because they are a big club, and it will be fascinating to see not only how Leeds get on back in the Premier League, but how Marcelo Bielsa reacts to the Premier League, because it's a heck of a different league to the Championship, that's for sure. And what he's done in the Championship has worked, albeit with questions about burnout, etc. But you look through that squad and there are a few who you back to make it in the Premier League. But the reality is, we said that about Norwich's players a year ago, and they've been found pretty wanting in the Premier League. Players like Ben White, whose loan ends, if they can't get deals like that done permanently, there's an awful lot of surgery to do on that squad moving forward, unless Bielsa feels he can squeeze even more out of them. But it does feel like, and this is a compliment, not an insult, it feels like he's squeezed everything out of that squad over the last two seasons. So to get them to push even further is, in my opinion, is a big ask. But, you know, they have a summer to address that.
Michael, what's your thoughts about Bielsa and Leeds in the Premier League?
Yeah, I agree with Daniel. I mean, Leeds are still a huge club, despite obviously the 15 years or so outside the Premier League. And yeah, it'll be exciting to have Bielsa back at the top level. He's gone quite mainstream, hasn't he, Bielsa? I preferred his stuff with Chile, but yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah, it should be fun. I mean, the way they played against Arsenal in the FA Cup game, I mean, they absolutely outplayed Arsenal, probably more than anyone's outplayed Arsenal under Arteta for the first 45 minutes in particular. So for those who are doubting whether they can do it in the Premier League, obviously it's different doing it in 45 minutes compared to 38 games, but that showed that they can really take, or they will take the game to the opposition.
They've got the structure, like Sheffield United had the structure. They're very, very comfortable with the philosophy, and they're a difficult team to play against. Sheffield United are really hard to play against because they're a bit unusual, make the pitch so big when they have the ball and then they shrink it. Leeds pose a lot of difficult questions for opponents. I think at both ends of the pitch, they need to recruit. I don't know if Ben White will stay. Surely Brighton will be looking to maybe use him. So they'll need quality at the back. And Bamford, as much as Bielsa loves him, is just not going to score enough goals in the Premier League. They have to upgrade in that position. But as a team, they'll be hard opponents. They really will.
The only thing that slightly goes against them is the fact that the manager is so kind of culturally notorious. When Sheffield United got promoted, there was a sense that they surprised managers with their approach. Now, any of those managers could have watched Sheffield United in the Championship, but they didn't change much. I think it's different with Leeds. I think everyone will kind of know what to expect. Now, knowing what to expect is very different to breaking it down and dismantling it, but I don't think they'll surprise teams like Sheffield United did.
Well, aside from Leeds United being promoted, everything else, I think I'm right in saying, Adrian, is still to be decided in the Championship, with one more round of matches still to come, and that's on Wednesday evening. The Totally Football League show will be out on Thursday to cover that. But Adrian, if you can give us a heads up now. So in promotion terms, you've got West Brom second, but they're only 1 point ahead of Brentford and only two clear of Fulham, with Forest and Cardiff in the other two playoff positions.
So much going on, James. It's going to be a real head spin on Wednesday night, that's for sure. I'm glad we're not recording straight after. We're going to sleep on it. But yeah, Brentford against Barnsley, massive at both ends of the table. You'd imagine that's bad news for Barnsley, that particular fixture. West Brom have Queen's Park Rangers, who in essence have nothing to play for. But when I look at Queen's Park Rangers' attack, they've got a lot of Mavericks there, a lot of flair players that given freedom, and when they can go out and just express themselves and have fun, I think they'll be dangerous opponents for a West Brom team that have definitely tightened up. So that's at the top. You've also got the playoffs. Swansea are still in with a sniff, but I think it's a very slim chance because Cardiff have Hull City at home, and I just can't see them blowing it. So Cardiff will probably make the playoffs, and then we haven't even got to the bottom. I mean, any one of a number of teams could go down, and even the team that does go down might then get a reprieve because of the Wigan points deduction that may or may not happen. So it's all a little bit bonkers, but I probably wouldn't want to be a Barnsley fan ahead of the last day because they've got Brentford. But all of them are playing reasonably well. You can make a case for all of them winning on the last day.
Right. Hull, Barnsley, Luton, Charlton, Wigan, Borough and Birmingham could all be relegated. Wigan currently 10 points clear, but facing a 12-point penalty after, not because of drawing with Charlton in this latest set of games, but, you know, that's what's meant that they're only 10 points clear. Mm. Meantime, Friday's 2-1 victory over West Brom, which of course saw Leeds promoted, saw changes at Huddersfield Town. The Cowley brothers, Danny and assistant manager, his brother Nicky, let go. Adrian, this was something of a surprise for most of us. Was it for you?
Definitely. I mean, if Nigel Pearson was a shocker, then this is an equal to that, in my opinion. They've just beaten West Bromwich Albion to survive in the Championship. Huddersfield were awful when the Cowley brothers took over. They couldn't score. They weren't keeping clean sheets. And they haven't been brilliant. They haven't been that exciting to watch. But they've ground out results and they've got over the line. I just wonder what's happened here. So again, it strikes me that something's gone on behind the scenes. They're very thorough, very intense coaches. Danny Cowley, he can go pretty deep. And he probably might not be every player's cup of tea. And I just wonder if one or two whispers filtered back to the boardroom about certain individuals maybe not being happy. Or is it a case of the ownership having a touch of snobbery. Danny Cowley, of course, came from non-league. Lincoln was where they recruited him from. And maybe they've got ideas in their head that now that they're safe, Huddersfield can suddenly kick on and play the beautiful game and get themselves promoted back into the Premier League with somebody fancier than the Cowleys. I don't get it. I don't think Huddersfield fans get it. It could be a big, big mistake, this decision. They have to get the appointment correct.
Yeah, I mean, I'm slightly putting my neck on the line, given that they may well have appointed their new manager when this comes out, but they aren't accepting applications for the job. I think it's fair to say that the Cowleys had a huge disagreement with the club about the amount of control they'd have in the transfer market. Huddersfield are going to lose a lot of players this summer on loan deal ending, etc. And I think they probably wanted more control than they were going to get. But if what I hear is correct, and it is only kind of whispers rather than solid rumour, but I think it might be quite a left field appointment. And if they do go down that route, if they do go down the kind of inexperienced import manager with no experience of English football and not much experience at first team level, it's a heck of a gamble for a club that's just flirted with relegation for a season from the third tier, you know, to go into the third tier. So I personally think it's a massive mistake.
Daniel, don't be a tease. So you're talking about a left field appointment with no experience.
I don't know the name. That's what I'm saying. But I think they're going to go left field on this. I think they're going to go for a kind of rip it up and start again. David Webb, their head of football operations, is also leaving, although that was pre-announced. So I think they're going to try and completely revamp the club in what is probably going to be a 5 or 6 week close season, which is, it's a huge gamble. Mm.
Well, the Cowley brothers won't be out of work long. Let me tell you that.
Bristol City, I think, maybe.
Yeah, they've been successful everywhere, literally everywhere they've been. So, they won't be short on offers. And yeah, Bristol City is a reasonable fit, I'd imagine. I would have thought that Chris Hughton might have got that gig by now. It hasn't happened. So yeah, I can see why they're among the favourites.
Shooting up high in the sky, the Cowley brothers. You'll be back then on Thursday with a big roundup of all the midweek championship news, who's up, who's down, and that. We'll be talking very, very shortly about the Premier League games coming up in the next few days. But before that, here's Lee Price with producer Ben.
Listeners, you've all seen Heat, right? With Al Pacino and Robert De Niro sharing some screen time. Well, this is the audio equivalent with added gambling tips. And Lee Price from Paddy Power, please kick us off. Watford versus Man City. Can Watford avenge that defeat earlier in the season with an 8-0 win of their own? And can Man City repeat it?
You can tell the season's almost over. It's like last day of school, isn't it? Let's start with the usual odds, should we say. Watford to win this match are 9-1. Manchester City are 1-4, heavy favourites as usual to take the 3 points. The draw is 9-2. As for someone winning 8-0, an 8-0 Watford win is 200-1. A Manchester City 8-0 win is also 200-1. In other words, a real long shot, as you might expect.
And finally, lots of angry words from Lionel Messi at the end of Barcelona's defeat to Osasuna, which handed the title to Real Madrid. And then we've all seen those pictures of Gareth Bale looking less than happy celebrating with his teammates. What are the odds, please, of Mr. G. Bale and Mr. L. Messi still being at their respective clubs at the start of next season?
Both players, Bale and Messi, are odds on to stay where they are by the time the transfer window shuts. But very different suitors, we think, for each. Messi, as you might expect, is 9-4 to join Man City. They're the favourites to get him. Juve second favourites are 4-1, and some of Europe's elite follow. Whereas for Gareth Bale, it's a very different vibe. Newcastle top the betting at 4-1 to sign him, ahead of any MLS team at 6-1. That kind of tells a story, doesn't it?
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Talking of things coming up this week, we've also got a Totally Football Show European edition out on Tuesday, a little bit later than usual because we're going to be waiting for Juve Lazio, which is taking place Monday night. We'll also be touching on all the other news from around the continent, including Real Madrid crowned champions of Spain. First time since 2017. Now, loads of Premier League coming up in the next few days as well. Monday sees Brighton taking on Newcastle. Sheffield United that same evening are up against Everton, the Blades chasing Europa League spot. Everton, meanwhile, 4 games now without a win. Crystal Palace are at Wolves, who are equally in the hunt for European football. Then on Tuesday, Watford against Man City and Aston Villa, Arsenal, huge games for the relegation scrap. And on Wednesday, Man United, West Ham and Liverpool, Chelsea. One game that we haven't touched on yet is Burnley's 2-0 victory away at Norwich. Nasty Norwich, who were down to 9 men on the worst run of their 118-year history, having lost 10 matches in a row in all competitions. They have also played 18 Premier League games in this calendar year and scored just 5 goals in those fixtures. Yikes. Norwich, Michael, we'll miss them.
I received an interesting tweet late on Saturday morning, actually, Friday night, if you like. They just read, "The absolute state of Norwich, a team for sniffy tactics turns to over," which I thought was interesting. And, you know, the fact it was directed at me, I think I've been implicated in that. But, I mean, I don't think really that anyone's been going mad about their tactics. I think most people started this season saying Cantwell's a good player, Buendia's a good player, Pukki's a good player. And yet when you look at their points tally, they're going to end up with the 6th lowest points total in the Premier League era. And the only teams worse than them have been an absolutely wretched Derby side, the Huddersfield team of last year who were hopeless, Villa of 4 years ago who were hopeless, and 2 Sunderland sides who I can't really differentiate in my mind because they were both so irredeemably awful. And you do have to ask questions of Daniel Farke, not necessarily the fact they're going down, but the fact they really do seem to have completely lost any form of belief. And the way that they lost on Saturday, obviously with the 2 red cards, it just points to, you know, a real lack of discipline, maybe of motivation, maybe of belief in Farke. And I do think that when you get into such a bad run like that, and I don't have the stats to support it, but my feeling is that can continue into next season. And for all the people like me who have been saying, well, they might go down this season, but they'll be in a good position to bounce back next season. When you lose 10 on the trot, I think you have to start questioning that.
Yeah, I think I absolutely agree. I mean, I know they've had this plan to basically take the money and run in the Premier League and use that broadcasting revenue to build a training ground and improve the club's infrastructure, etc., etc. But Burnley are the only club really that recently that have managed to do that, to take that money and then rebuild and come back stronger. But Sean Dyche is a very different character to Daniel Farke. And I think Michael's right. It takes a huge effort of man management to turn around that mood. And as we've said about lots of things, is going to be an incredibly short, close season. They're not going to have 3 months to do this. They're going to have 2 or 3 weeks.
I think Farke has inadvertently cost Norwich City a lot of money in the transfer market, because the way that they've played, because his inability to change their approach, to build a stronger, sturdier defensive platform, I think has let down talented guys like Cantwell and Buendia to some degree. They've just not had, they've been playing in such a despondent side. There's been very, very little service into them. And as a consequence, I don't know whether there will be enough suitors in for them to pay the big money. And you could probably say the same about Ben Godfrey. They believe he's worth £50 million. I mean, it doesn't look like a £50 million centre half to me. I don't think anyone in that Norwich lineup looks like they're worth over 20, if I'm being perfectly honest. So yeah, I just feel that they've been so bad towards the end that they are going to see their transfer kitty shrunk by player sales this summer.
Tim Krul will have some suitors, though, I imagine.
Yeah. No, he's been busy, hasn't he? He's probably been their player of the year, hasn't he, Tim Krul? He's made a lot of great saves. I just don't know.
£5 million goalkeeper, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't think he's not a Premier League star anymore. I don't think he's going to bring in too much in revenue.
Buendia getting himself banned for the first 2 games of next season probably won't help him.
Yeah, good shout.
Pretty bleak are the prospects then in East Anglian football. We have come to the end of today's show, listener, but as mentioned before, there's loads of other stuff coming up ever so soon, with Tuesday's Euro edition, with the Totally Football League show on Thursday, and with another Totally Football show also on Thursday, in which we'll be looking forward to that incredible final Sunday of this campaign, and loads of other stuff as well. Many, many thanks to Adrian. It was a delight to have you along today.
Yeah, no, good fun. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Excellent. And also to Daniel and Michael, and look forward to catching up with you all again soon. Many thanks as well to producer Charlie. Listener, we're out of here. We'll catch up with you soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Muddy Knees Media.